Just to kind of introduce you guys to the importance of soil. Our company, like Sarah said, started out as a garden center and landscape company, and our approach is to really rebuilding and restoring soil naturally, and that's with farms, institutions, homeowners, really across the board. A couple quotes that I live by. Franklin D. Roosevelt: a nation that destroys its soil destroys itself. And what we've kind of begun to realize is that what we're doing to this to the farmland, to ourselves is really destroying the soil. And what that's doing is we're directly related to that soil in every way. Everything that we eat, everything that we drink has a direct effect on what we're doing to that soil. Another one by Leonardo da Vinci: we know more about the movement of celestial bodies ahead, overhead, than the soil underfoot. And basically what we're trying to get at is there's a life of microorganisms living below our feet in the soil that we've kind of neglected for so long. And here's just a real quick simplified representation of what's known as the soil food web. It's that structure of life that exists in the soil, a living, breathing organism, all working in symbiosis with each other, breaking down organic matter, cycling the nutrients, decreasing compaction. And the problem with the industrialized food system is that we're using all of these synthetic fertilizers. And I want you to think for a moment, these old growth forests. We've got massive, beautiful old growth forests throughout our continent, throughout our world, and we don't really realize it. These forests were grown with no fertilizer, with no irrigation system. Really what was responsible was that life in the soil, all of those microorganisms that were responsible for breaking down the matter, successing that soil forward, and growing these healthy, huge trees. And I think for so long we've been trained into the fact that we have to feed the plant. And it's kind of the impact that the chemical revolution has brought on us, is that we've got to feed the plant, and the chemical industries have taught us that we've got to feed it with synthetic fertilizer. Synthetic fertilizers, if you guys are unaware, are petroleum-based. And what they, you know, that's like a 10-10-10 NPK, and it's really having a detrimental effect on our soil, on us, and on our environment. Just a couple of major impacts of the conventional fertilizers that we're using. The nitrous oxide that's released from these synthetic nitrogen fertilizers is really has a detrimental effect on the warming potential, and 300 times more warming than carbon dioxide. And synthetic fertilizers are the number one cause of nitrous oxide gassing into the atmosphere. And then on the other side, the synthetic fertilizers that we're using require a large amount of energy to produce, and they're petroleum based, which I don't really have to go into much more about why that's a bad thing. And I think most importantly, the point that I want to get across is we're destroying our soil with the use of these synthetic fertilizers. 50 years ago, 60 years ago, at the onset of the Industrial Revolution, these chemical companies found that if we feed the plant and kept that plant in this needing more synthetic food, that it would ultimately destroy the soil. Destroying the soil means more pests, more disease, so in turn you're stuck in the cycle of having to use more chemicals that, you know, have led to every disease known to man. And that's really where we need to begin shifting our focus, is to, you know, feeding and restoring that soil naturally. A couple of the other problems with conventional fertilizer is that it's kind of taken compost in that recycling of nutrients out of the equation. And the darker the soil it is, the more energy that it absorbs from the sun. If we're not putting any sort of organic matter back into that soil, the problem that we're running into is that it's not soaking up that heat. And it's amazing the amount of global warming that can be reduced by putting organic matter back into your soil. And if we did that on a large scale, we would be attracting a lot more heat into the soil. Compacted soils, again, the use of synthetics, are really destroying that life in the soil, and that life is responsible for aerating and building the healthy soil. And so compacted soils equal major problems with drought. And especially after we've got farm equipment running over it, and you can see that picture there of just clay soil. That's an indication that there's very little organic matter in the soil, and using these synthetics really burns up a lot of that organic matter in the soil and leaves us with a ton of problems. Here's one farmer that we've got the opportunity to work with down in Rutherford County. He was a strawberry farmer, and for the last 15 years he had been told by the university that he needed to use a regimen of synthetic fertilizers and chemicals on his strawberry farm. What he's done to his fields is pretty much destroyed all of that beneficial life, and so he's got this horrible problem with anthracnose. And strawberry farms should typically have that problem because they're using massive amounts of fungicide. And the reason why they're using massive amounts of fungicide is because the lice is in that soil to really protect and support that plant. This is him actually not spraying chemicals, but spraying compost tea. And one of the solutions to beginning to rebuild that soil. I love it because for 15 years he destroyed it. Now he's realizing that he's got to make compost and brew his own compost tea and put it back on in his field. And one of the most important things about rebuilding the soil, it all really begins with compost and that mix of life that goes back in it. And what compost is basically microorganisms of every degree. You're going to want compost that's as arrayed as possible in fungal, bacterial, protozoan, and nematode counts. Those are the main microorganisms that you're looking at. And really, 10 minutes is just really tough to go over the whole array of it. And another one that I love is mycorrhiza. Mycorrhiza is a beneficial root fungus in the soil that works in symbiosis with the plant root. Mycorrhiza has learned to support its host food source by forming an extension of that plant root and going out searching nutrients and searching water for that plant so that it can keep it alive, because it's being fed by the exudates and the sugars that come off the root. And this is what we're ultimately destroying in the soil by using those synthetic fertilizers that ultimately wind up in our watershed and in our groundwater. And then we're having to use more chemicals to combat all of the diseases that we onslaught. And again, that soil food web is so important. If we're not focused on building life in the soil, we will ultimately not be focused on building life in our civilization. And again, the quote, a nation that destroys its soil destroys itself. It is so important that we begin to move in the light of building our local food system through supporting small farmers, buying organically, and buying locally. And I appreciate your comments. So I'll pass it off to the next one.
When Sarah asked me to do this presentation, she was asking me, as an organic farmer, I had, we've had Westwind Farms and produced organic livestock for 13 years. She didn't realize that I was also a regulatory, environmental regulatory specialist when I wasn't on the farm, and I am a deep core environmentalist. So, but really, this sort of thing, and what I'm going to talk about today, is the very reason why we started farming. Because we had very deep beliefs about what was happening in the environment, a lot of which was due to agriculture, and so that was kind of what drove us into farming, partially, one of the main things. I don't have presentation overheads today, but I'll talk to you about some of the things that we saw as being really significant issues that we felt as individuals we had a responsibility to act to change. It's one thing to look at it from the outside and say, this is too bad. And it's another thing to step in and do it. And so some of the indicators of what's happening in our environment today, in agriculture, in our food system, is related to the source of where we're getting our food, to that right down to its genetics. And what's happening is there's, of course, a threat of genetic uniformity due to monoculture and confinement operations that focus on maybe one or two livestock breeds. I've got some statistics. I hopefully won't wear you out with statistics, but I think it brings the point home. When we think about agriculture, you sometimes think of farms as being, green and you know, the type of harms that probably we are all here and interested in. But, you know, that's not the majority of the farms. 10 to 20% of the crops that are produced in the United States provide 80 to 90% of the world's calories. But 38 to 43% of those are dominated by just six top varieties of vegetables. Corn, wheat, soybean predominantly. The hundreds of corn hybrids that we produce in the United States are largely based on just 12 inbred lines from just a few open pollinated varieties of a single race. Now, if that doesn't strike you as being an issue with food security, you know, what will? We're so dependent on these monocultures for our food, and just a little bit of diversity would certainly help. A lot of people believe that genetic engineering, and this is, you know, of course, a controversial topic, but genetic engineering may be the answer to that. Maybe we can put genes or modify varieties to make them more resistant to disease. And really, where that is one thought process, the other thought process is that they may actually transfer into the wild populations and cause genetic pollution. Super weeds could develop, of course. Resistant insects. And I think that there's been some studies that have shown evidence that all of these things can happen. So we have some great risk and concern associated with genetic engineering to solve our problems in that area. And it's not a baby anymore. Genetic engineering is not a baby. Globally, just in 1996, there were 6.4 million acres that were in planted to genetically modified, genetically engineered plants. In 1999, it had way more than doubled at 102.5 million acres. I mean, that is exponential. It is the top ranking technological advance in agriculture right now. Just in the U.S., 22% of all our cropland is planted to genetically modified seeds. And it's not just plants, it's livestock, livestock consolidation and uniformity. Our domestic livestock breeds are disappearing at 5% annually worldwide. That's 6 breeds per month. Artificial insemination, embryo transfer, in vitro fertilization, and cloning all contributed to that. 90% of all commercially produced turkeys in the world come from just 3 breeding flocks in the world. Amazing. So we've got issues with the source of our food and whether we're incorporating enough biodiversity into what we produce. Another aspect is our agricultural growing and production techniques. We want to talk about soil erosion. Soil erosion is a huge issue in agriculture. Huge. 1997, 3.07 billion tons eroded from the United States land. Most of that from land and agricultural production. To put that in context, that would be the same amount of soil in freight cars on a train that wrapped around the world 7 times, just from the United States, eroded. It's gone. In 1997, Tennessee actually had the highest sheet and grill rate on cultivated cropland at 7.7 tons per year. We were up there right at the top.
What is that with the sheep and grill rate?
It's the washing away. It's erosion of the land. We could wash out.
So we had the top
in in 1997.
Number one or two?
We were number one.
So almost like how that picture where it shows the picture of the ground that had all the cracks in it. Yeah. That's one example of when the ground is not absorbing water.
The water washes the soil away when it's not properly covered with crop cover and organic matter.
That's part because of the drought.
Not in
97.
The social costs of soil erosion have been estimated at $29.7 billion in 1997. Now, conservation reserve programs, things that the Natural Resource Conservation Service are doing, a lot of those things are really turning things around, at least in Tennessee. We've improved quite a bit with some of the riparian zones around creeks and that sort of thing. It's really helped quite a bit. So it's not a terrible story, but it's definitely the story where we need to come up and we're working on trying to get better at that. Nutrient loss and pollutants are an issue with runoff. Commercially manufactured chemical fertilizers are a significant issue. In 1997, 6.4% of total farm production expenses went to commercial fertilizers. 6.4% of all farm expenses went to commercial fertilizers. Now, where they say there was an increase of maybe of, well, confinement livestock operations also are unable to really make use of the manure. You know, where it's good to use the natural fertilizers, what happens is confinement operations are so confined, concentrated to specific areas that they're not close to the croplands that can use it. And so the expense of actually transporting that manure to places that can use it beneficially exceeds the benefit, you know, their ability to do it or their willingness to do it, whatever the case. So it becomes a waste as something else we need to deal with. Pesticides are also an issue as far as the runoff and filtration. Just the particulate that runs off can cause a lot of damage in our streams. In 2000, 7.6% of Tennessee's rivers and 17% of Tennessee's lakes were too polluted to support all of their uses. So you can't go swimming there, you can't go boating there, you can't fish there, whatever the issue, because of these things. 37% of Tennessee's water pollution comes from agriculture. So we've got a lot of room to make change, and each one of us who are interested in sustainable agriculture knows the answer. You know, it has to come from our small group to make change. So it's not just filtration of water, it's also air pollution. And this is an area that touches on the livestock operation. Ammonia is one of the six top criteria pollutants in the United States. And 90% of that is estimated to come from livestock. We're talking about confinement, livestock, those operations where it's highly concentrated, where it can't get reworked into the grass and the soil and captured. Also, 7.7% of greenhouse gas comes from agriculture. And then pesticides, you think about pesticides on the soil running off, pesticides also are captured in the air and settle out. They travel in the air and they settle out in our lakes and our streams. And it was estimated that Lake Superior that had identified atrazine in their lakes, and 95% of that came from atmospheric pollution from spraying. So, what's the answer? Biodiversity. Recycle the nutrients, regulate the microclimates and the hydrology with the practices that we all know work sustainably. That will even detoxify some of those noxious chemicals. And we're using water at an unprecedented rate. Irrigation took 39% of all fresh water withdrawals in the United States in 1995. I don't know what that is now, but there's certain areas that they're depleting their water sources, and they won't return. They'll just turn into desert. And I think we'll see that. I can't think of where it is. But anyway, we're going to see that happening in more areas more frequently now. Okay. That's the production end. We also have environmental impacts from the distribution side. We can probably guess what some of those are. But it was estimated in a life cycle analysis, which is really a good thing to apply to some of the agricultural practices, because you can see not just the short end, but you can see actually what the true cost is. And maybe it's not just borne by the farm, but it's borne by our entire society. Energy that was consumed by the manufacturing industry in producing our food in the United States exceeded the total energy that was provided by the food. Isn't that amazing? For example, a can of soda takes 2,200 kilocalories to produce, versus one kilocal in food energy it provides. And it's not just soda. A can of corn took 15,675 kilocals per kilogram versus the 3,600 kilocals per kilogram, food energy per kilogram it provided. And that's in the additional processing. So what does that say? Buy fresh whenever you can. Buy local whenever possible. Food packaging. 33% of cardboard packaging that landed up in the landfill came from our food packaging. So if we can go to the farmer's market and buy food there, we can eliminate some of that packaging. Now we're getting better on that end because we're doing more recycling and composting and stuff, and that's really a good thing. And let's see. It was noted that sometimes those specialty items, those items that are made for specific purposes, like hot dog buns or I can't think of another example. Oh, sour cream, things that you can buy ready-made in the store that are sometimes impulse buys too, some of those things have a greater frequency of showing up in somebody's household trash than a staple, like, you know, a loaf of bread per se, not just a hot dog, but a loaf of bread. So that's something to be aware of in our food purchases. And it's all about our food choices. It's all about our food choices. The Union of Concerned Scientists named food as one of the most environmentally harmful consumer activities. From meat and poultry from confinement operations were one of the worst because it had so much involved in it that was not good. That was one aspect that if you could just stop doing that one thing would have impact. Now don't stop buying grass-fed or meat. Also, buying organic food was a good choice. And it was noted that good food choices in a household can make a greater impact than any other household operation, basically. Like if you want to install efficient lighting or, you know, install heat pump or whatever. If you're just like doing something like, I'm going to choose paper over plastic, those things are insignificant next to making good food choices for the environment. So that's basically my point.
Okay, well, my name is Dave Kaiser. I don't claim to be an expert on ag or environmental things, and I don't have a lot of statistics, but I am a fifth-generation farmer from Nebraska, though. I grew up on a farm. We've adapted over the years, started out a potato farm, and then the railroads took it out to Idaho, and we stopped doing potatoes. Then we did dairy, then we did hogs, and we did cattle, and now we're just traditional, you know, corn and soybeans. But, you know, we've had to adapt over the generations to survive. We have a plat map 1913 of all the farmers in our area. Today we're the only one left. And we're lucky, we're the first one to settle on a county, so we're able to have a bunch of land stuff to survive. But now that's kind of the case with the industrial farms. The small farmers, they can't afford to keep their farm going. They sell out. Next thing, a big farmer comes in. They get rid of all the hedgerows. You lose your wildlife habitat ecosystems for pheasants and wild birds. And then you end up with large commercial industrial factory farms just pumping out the food with no taste or anything like that. So that's where I came from. And then, you know, with soil erosion and chemicals and herbicides, growing up as a little kid, I used to fish in this creek called Clear Creek, and we used to catch bass out of that creek. And today, it's a sponge. It's full of moss from all the nitrates that have eroded through the water system into that creek. So I get emotional about that. So, but I'm here now. I just moved to Nashville. I work for a nonprofit called Cumberland Region Tomorrow. We're a nonprofit. We were created in 2000 through a strong coalition of local leaders and Vanderbilt University. They recognized the population trends and data that came out of the census in 2000 that something's got to be done about the Middle Tennessee region. Basically, our elevator pitch is we're trying to keep Nashville from turning into Atlanta. And during the early processes in 2001 to 2003, we went through a modeling case where we looked at how things are growing, leapfrog, sprawl, land consumption, congestion, the way we're building our houses, the million-dollar McMansions that we put up, the cookie-cutter homes. And we looked at that data, and then we came back and looked at alternative cases. You know, if you were to do it with some smart growth practices, you know, how much land are we going to consume? If we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to consume 365,000 acres of land that's not urbanized and suburbanized. If we go with smart growth techniques, having more city-centered development, smaller housing lots, funding for mass transit, other modes of transportation to get around the city, not rely just on our car, but better zoning, things like that, we could only use 91,000 acres. So there's a huge savings of land. And you mentioned some figures about where a lot of our food, a lot of our calories are produced around. A lot of that's around urbanized and suburbanized areas. Well, that's going to be the first land that we consume. So then we just keep handing more and more farms over to the large corporate farms as we keep doing that. And I'm a foodie. I love to eat. You see, big guy. I've ate well. But I like a tomato that tastes like a tomato. And you know, we produce beef right now in Nebraska, and we don't get to consume in Nebraska, which I find really interesting. We sell all of our beef to Kroger's. We don't have one Kroger's in Nebraska. Isn't that crazy? So, you know, these are some things. So, our body of work is getting out and educating local elected leaders, planning professionals about quality growth techniques and what they can do about it. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. We've been working in the 10 counties around Nashville, doing trainings and stuff. And we focus on 5 chapter areas. We look at housing, the housing life cycle, and what you can do with that. Transportation and land use, not just, you know, planning your development around the interstate and leapfrogging it. I found out about some interesting stuff about this decentralized septic systems that are going out. Because the environment, but it's actually going to increase sprawl. Because then you can put subdivision anywhere, taking up farmland and transportation. Then also just the CO2 emissions from driving and everything also affect farming as well. So there's lots of resources out there that you can find on our website that you can use to save land. There's like Land Trust for Tennessee, it's the big one here, and they're doing a marvelous job. Keep supporting those guys. But also, like with economic development, my background is also in economic development, and we're always pushing to develop land, and now I've kind of seen the light. I'm like, let's conserve land and be smart about it. There's resources out there or tactics that you can use, such as purchase of development rights. So the farmer doesn't lose the land, he can sell rights. So if that developer ever comes up with that idea of doing some type of corporate development, he'll come in and do it. But the farmer doesn't lose the land, he still keeps the land, and hopefully that development never happens. There's lease of development rights, transfer development rights. Another thing, write the farm law. This is a big one. With our cattle farm, you know, we produce a lot of manure. I spread a lot of cow manure in my life, I'll tell you that. I started driving the tractor when I was 8, and yeah, sure, age of 25 or so, that's what I did. Did a lot of that. Well, anyway, Omaha, growing up in Nebraska, we were 30 minutes from the edge of Omaha. Well, now the edge of Omaha is 10 minutes away. People are leapfrogging over Platte Creek and into our area, and the next thing we know, we get called in by the EPA because of the smell. So we've been there 5 generations. And so these are issues, you know. The right of farm laws, that's a good thing to support, so the farmer has some rights. And then ag zoning. That's another way you protect farmland, is zoning and agriculture. Identifying it to GIS and then protecting it. And that's another resource out there. And then I can't help it, but I got to talk about biofuels and impact on the environment and farming, because this has been affected the grocery store. But we produce corn, soybeans, and we feed cattle. And the only reason we feed cattle is to add value to our corn. You get $3 a bushel for corn, you feed it through a steer or heifer, you're getting about $4 a bushel of corn. It's the only reason my dad produces or feeds cattle. Well, now with the prices of corn going up, he's like, oh, if I can get $6 a bushel, I don't need to feed cattle anymore. Think about that. How is that going to affect you in the grocery store with just basic beef? And I can go on to chicken, pork, whatever. And so So it's going to definitely have some impact because you're taking the feedstock and now making it a fuel. So we need to do some more research on looking for some more commodity crops that we can produce oils with and fuels with besides corn, soybeans. We definitely need to do that. So kind of works out fast, though.
Yeah,
we'll open up for questions. You guys are the experts. You guys are the ones working on it.
So. Yeah. I'd like to throw out that maybe if we take a
10-minute break before lunch, we can go a little bit past 11:45, which is our slated time, if that's not good with you, you can just walk outside. Yeah, I'd like to open up first, Thomas. I am the son of a dairy farmer who's the son of a dairy farmer
yeah.
I've had two very clear and distinct colleagues in my life. Had to be college because I did not want any more. One of them was agriculture, the other one was the ministry. My undergraduate degree is in dairy science from Clemson University, and my master's and my doctoral work are in theology. And, holy cow. I never understood that mix. And then all of it, sudden I discovered sustainable agriculture, and all of a sudden theology came together with sustainability, and I became the sustainable and urban agriculture consultant to the United Methodist Church in charge of North America. And so it made sense. And I've been asked by the Dean of Theology at Candler Theological at Emory to write a book on sustainability as the theological issue of this century. And finally, the faith-based, which is, in my opinion, that cornbread ain't good, has not been involved in this issue, and they're coming more to it now. What I love about sustainability and sustainable agriculture that it's moved so far ahead of the environmental movement. Where I think the environmental movement has made a huge mistake is that it has pitted the tree hugger against the lumberjack. And having managed dairy farms from 70 milking cows to the mega farms of 2000, that's a lot of crap. That is a lot of manure. I remember sweating green paint when it rained because the new Department of Health and Environmental Control was going to be camping out at my place to catch runoff and make a $30,000 fine, and in the dairy business, that would drive you clean out of business. Now, what I applaud you on is, it's hard to be an organic farmer with animals because you are required to feed, if you do feed grain and don't do a pasture rotation, organic grain. You think, number one, it's hard to find organic grain growers that want to supply you with enough grain to feed your animals. So I've got a dear friend of mine that was named Sustainable Farmer of the Year last year, dairy farmer in South Carolina, Tommy Trantham. And he rotationally grazes his whole thing. His production costs fell by 40%. He now pasteurizes as much as on milk. Low batch temperature pasteurization. He does not homogenize his milk. The soil samples are showing that it would not need even synthetic fertilizer, which you wouldn't use anyway. But the beautiful thing is now he's got the doctors in upstate South Carolina camping out at his place because he's got lactose intolerant people drinking his milk with no problem. You know, and one of the things that I think that we've got to do to promote more sustainable agriculture is setting up more direct markets. Because I found myself raised in corporate agriculture and educated in corporate agriculture. And I thought environmentalists weren't there. I thought it was unrealistic.
Did you want to talk a little bit about how you, your how you feed your
animals? Well, we're similar because we grass feed all of the ruminants.
One.
And the cattle and the sheep and the goats.
I kind of had a question about that, just the last thing that Dave said about biofuels, and it's something that I read about a lot, you know, it's unethical to use corn to make gas and feed people, or produce cattle, feed cattle. And after reading the Beyond the Word Dilemma, about corn being fed to cattle, and about grass-fed, and intensive rotation, dill salad in the farm, and those kinds of things, so I thought it was great to have you both on the panel, and I wanted to ask about that. Because to me it seems like, well, if we quit feeding corn to cattle, not going to cattle anyway, these organic practices to intensively raise our cattle, have healthy beef, have healthy farms, then can we use the corn to make biofuels? Does it become ethical again? Or is that just kind of a small view that doesn't take into, you know, global concerns? So I thought you both, with the soils that you're taking, you made that.
The farmers would need to have access to the land to graze. And that's, yeah, you know, a significant limitation for us. Yeah. That the price of land these days is not priced for grazing cattle.
Yeah.
And so if you take them out of the corn production, you've got to have a place for them to eat. And what we process, if I'm right on this, we process something like 800,000 head of cattle a day in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of grass.
What's the acre cost that works where it does make a living, where you can make a living?
Well, depending on how good the grass is and everything,
usually
one animal unit per acre is optimal.
Yeah.
Do you have any place in Tennessee where you can still do that? And you
know, there's some. It's not on the plateau.
So is it not a sustainable option? Is it not a sustainable solution to create a large scale, I mean, a small scale so people can be feast out in the grass and feed, but it's not a large scale solution for large populations?
Yeah, there needs to be a lot more work done on the local scale organic beef market. It's just not big enough for my father to get into. So we have to feed corn so we can have the gains per day, the average gain per day. Because if you don't have the average gain up, you're going to lose a ton of money, and we're not going to be farming tomorrow. That's why, I mean, we love to feed grass, and but it would take twice as long to feed cattle out and making money. It's a corporation. Farming is really a corporation, and you're trying to put food on your own table.
That's the thing. The farmers are driven to less sustainable practices in order to keep farming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really driven so much by economics.
The average price of corn for a bushel, average price for a bushel of corn hasn't gone up since 1940.
Yeah.
Okay, that's silly. And but a combine will cost you $250,000.
Yeah.
And fuel's gone up, all these other things, labor's gone up.
And we've got the cheapest food in the nation on top of that.
Yeah.
And so the farmer gets, even, you know, you pay the price, the cheapest price in the nation, was it, in the world, for food, and yet the American farmer gets like 8 cents out of every dollar, I think is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, farmers are like, you know,
and I think that the point that Kimberly just made is an important one, because globally our food costs in America are the lowest compared to any other country in the entire world. Yet we are paying higher health care costs, and we are paying our farmers even less. So they're all having to struggle or use maybe less sustainable, higher yield. Not even to say that chemical inputs equal higher yields, because I think a diversified farm is really demonstrates is very yield producing. But you know, we're paying for that in the externalities somewhere else. Anthony, and then the different effect.
I think that the whole movement towards sustainable ag at a low farm is a mix of things. It's going to take the land trust, CDR, all that stuff for some development, like you know, recently the loss of cultivatable land and farmable land is a huge, huge problem. But the other thing is that, and then there's the price issue, you know, it's this incredible irony that we can't seem to wrap our heads around that we talk about it, say, well, it'll cost the consumer more and all that, and yet, you know, we have this tremendous problem with health and obesity in our country for a lot of reasons. We're too sedentary, number one, but the biggest thing is we just eat much, much more than our parents did. Our caloric intake has grown almost by 70% just in the last generation. So you can start to see solutions on the horizon that for a lot of things that we're all working on that are kind of peripheral now need to come together to make that happen. One is, you know, if you pay 30 to 40% more for grass-based beef and livestock, that would probably bring your consumption down to a level much more healthy for you. And the last thing I'll throw in is petroleum is going to be the great equalizer. The reality is that we're probably on the other side of the peak oil we're pretty close to that natural gas. Those are the two linchpins of the modern agriculture system. One way or another, in 30 or 40 years, we're going to have a very different way of both producing and moving food. Mm-hmm. It's just simply, there's nothing on the horizon that can replace petroleum and natural gas in the way that we've used it. And so I think both local transactions and more sustainable grass-based and soil organic matter-based farming are simply going to be much more cost competitive, not because they're going to get cheaper, but because the other way is going to get more expensive. And when my children are my age, food is not going to cost 8 or 9% of the household budget. It's going to be more like what it is in Europe, 20 or 25 or 30%. And that need not be a bad thing. A long-term policy can take care of folks
I was just at the New Partners for Smart Growth conference in D.C. last week, and listened to some presenters from the American Farmland Trust. Mm-hmm. Just throw out some stats. You know, 6 billion people on Earth right now. We currently produce enough food to feed 12 billion people. There's 800 million people starving, and there's 1.7 billion people obese. And being a Peace Corps volunteer, and some fellow Peace Corps friends in the building here, ate seasonally for 4 years. Over in North Africa, the food was great. And I remember anticipating the mandarin orange season in October. It went from October to January, but that was it. But you could get a kilo mandarin for a dime, and that was about 60 pounds lighter then. I just ate so healthy. The food tasted so good. And I think seasonal is, you know, a good way to go. I remember as a kid, you know, gardening, we had fruit trees, we had a garden. And whatever was left over, we canned and froze, and we ate that during the winter. But now we expect to have strawberries in December. We expect to have, you know, tomatoes in February. So, something of a lifestyle. Yeah.
Initially, when Roundup came out, Monsanto had claimed that it breaks down so quickly that it, you know, is rendered inert, but you know, recent findings have seen that it's still intact and that it's going into our groundwater. And I think really, you know, the whole genetic modification, the whole biofuels industry of corn and soybean is only to sell more genetically engineered crops and more Roundup. I mean, it's amazing the amount of Roundup that we're putting out these days. And, it's, you know, it's just because they greenwashed biofuels and called it a good thing. When, you know, unfortunately, I mean, switchgrass, yes, possibly, ultimately, when we're trying to fuel ourselves, fuel our body, and fuel our economy, we're ultimately getting the energy from the sun. And that's what the plants are doing. I think what we need to do is cut out one step of that process. Instead of having the plants gather that energy from the sun and then produce that fuel from the plant, just gather it directly. I don't know why there hasn't been so much more of a push into solar production, and going back to the Roundup. I mean, we're really poisoning ourselves. I mean, the majority of the population doesn't realize the amount of chemicals that go on a day-to-day basis, you know, what it's doing to our wildlife, what it's doing to the soil biology. We're destroying that life system in the soil with all of these chemicals that go out.
And this Roundup corn that has been introduced now,
It's
having the same results of resistance,
mm-hmm.
I can imagine eating pesticides around the corn.
Yeah.
But one of the things that kills me about, I'm now living in Indiana, I'm coming back to Nashville, mark my words. about Indiana, ethanol production is a big issue to corn territory. There is nothing more damaging to the fertility of soil than corn.
Yeah. Yep. And then nothing. When I was a kid, the first job I had was walking soybeans. I walked soybeans at age 8. Back then, there was a whole bunch of kids from high school and junior high that would take up jobs at farms and walk to hundreds and hundreds of acres of soybean fields during the day and cut the weeds by hand instead of spraying Roundup on them. But as the small farms started to leave, as it became harder for farmers to keep food on their table and send their kids to college, the kids had to go to college, get a career, and it's just really hard for someone with a master's degree to come back home to a small town of 1,500 people and get a job that will pay for their student loans have a better life. So I'm sad to say, I'm the farm's probably going to end with me unless I get the guts to go back. But we're losing that workforce that's out there that could replace the Roundup.
Lorna, and then the woman back in the market.
Could farm subsidies be restructured to support sustainable agricultural farms and stuff now? What
a good thing.
I saw something on television about how in Germany isn't there a subsidy program in effect for solar? For it was about farmers who would set up rows and rows of solar panels, and we're doing that. And I believe there was some sort of government incentive. I was wondering if any of y'all had any.
Don't know about that.
So, and does everybody understand sort of framing the subsidy and genetic engineering issue in the U.S.? I mean, the reason that our systems in large part have moved to large-scale corporate monoculture farms or corn and soy farms are because of the billion-dollar industry where I think it's $28 billion over the past 10 years. That has ripple effects through our whole economy. It is amounted to, I believe, $5 to $6 billion every year of subsidy to the poultry and beef operations because they're able to buy this cheap corn and soy. So I think that that is where we're getting most of the 80% of the food that we're actually eating coming from these six varieties is because of that corporate industrial model being perpetuated by a subsidy.
There's some government incentives that have been used for good purposes. You can tell which side of the fence I'm on, good purposes. CRP program for the riparian zones. I mean, the government was cost sharing that. There's other cost share things that really started to turn around some of the environmental issues that we have. And small farms can use those. I don't know how I feel about subsidies, though. I mean, ideally, I think I'd like to see our culture support themselves.
I think part of the Farm Bill, and all the conservation reserve programs, they're all different programs within the Farm Bill. The study project, the CACI you mentioned, those were part of the community food projects of the Farm Bill. Subsidies just make up the most expensive and biggest project.
It's interesting how much money you said, too, went into Tennessee, because I think there's only, not the only, but 26 confinement.
Well, that's for
operations.
All of the programs. That was nationally.
I did a survey. It was a very informal survey a couple of months ago, and talking to people about genetically modified food and make changing this a little bit. And their comment was, and these were educated people, but their comment was, I trust that the government's going to do the right thing for me, so when I go buy my food on the shelf, I know the government's doing the right thing. And it almost struck me as, wow, you put that much trust in this large corporation that's there to make a lot of money. And so they were almost really kind of lackadaisical and thought, what's going to be on that shelf is convenient, and I trust the government, and that's where I'm going to go. But even though I was giving a lot of statistics and saying, hey, maybe you need to step back. I ran into a lot of balls. I don't want to be pretty. Yeah, it was just something
else. Well, and I think that everybody can, vote with your dollar. So if Tana Comer invests in an organic vegetable farm, she's certified organic, or even if she's saying she's natural growing, certified natural growing, you can't use GMO products at all. Mark, do you?
A couple of comments about Dave on biofuels. What we're seeing is really a false economy on corn. Corn is the least BTUs. We're involved in a large project in Southeast because I'm pretty stable. Not getting it from the grant, but I need to look at the waste stream. Most of the 10 county regions around the Chattanooga, 60% of that is the same. paper started making. They've already got a source for the ethanol fuel. I already planted down there in Mary City. We're looking at I'm also an organic farmer. I used to be an organic dairy farmer, but the drought didn't hit the farm. All my three neighbors on the simple I'm on the road the whole way have all got kind of cattle business off the ground. You don't realize how much water cattle drink you got to start bringing to it. So we're seeing a real climate change impact on the environment, on agriculture, where we're going to have to have shifts away from corn production. We can't solve energy bill problem mandate for ethanol with corn-based fuels. It takes almost like energy to make ethanol corn. For sale, through the process, yes. So we're going to start seeing real, which is apparently Walt Vandross has converted all their landfills to sale of ethanol plants. And they're told that the three plants in Southern California get a production of renewable energy for 50 years trend in agriculture. Right now, the cost of energy is on Midwestern farmers. The corn seems to be paid back. Please drip everything in the
I think in Illinois, you know, there's the crop rotation, soybean corn. In Illinois, I think corn's gone up 10%, just reacting to ethanol boom. It's like the wild, wild west. When I was working up there, ethanol developers were knocking on my door and saying, you know, so we're putting an ethanol plant in here, and it just required so much water. I had this one guy who came in, I was working at the next ethanol developer. He wanted to put in a 200 million gallon ethanol plant, which was going to use up 90 billion bushels of corn, or 90 million. And the six county region around that produced 110 million annually. So all that corn that used to be fed to livestock or into the food system is going to go into fuel. So, we scared them away by
the current system is kind of set up to have a lot of progression as well as a lot of digression. You know, it's a progression that's going to kind of digress in the end, the way the current system is set up. And it seems that people here who are in the room are curious about choices and decisions and what they choose to put out from their income. That seems like have an effect. That's the most closest direct effect we can have with anyone sitting in here. Wanting to make the fact that it's the choices that we make on a daily basis, the corn up the farmer's market, choosing the thing on the shelf that you feel is farmed in a certain practice that's benefiting the environment as a whole. Those are such the important choices. And sometimes when you're comparing things in prices, if you are at a local grocery store, you know, it might seem so much easier to go with a thing that's priced a little bit less. But the impact that has when you take everyone in this room and everyone in the room next to it, you know, it's just the more coins we have throwing into the stream, the small ripple, I have to think that there's some sense of honesty and appreciation towards just making the right decision.
Well, as most of you, I don't know how many of you are following, but as he votes, as Alexander, but Senator Alexander, but in December, he voted against the provisions that in the energy bill, it blocked and it excluded them from the energy bill of 2007 that would have required that 15% of energy power plants be from renewable sources. And that again in the stimulus bill was the reason why the Republicans voted against the stimulus bill in the first instance, and then they had to come back around in the Senate without the provisions that the Democratic majority and some others wanted to have for credits for sustainable and renewable energy. But I think one of the issues that you bring up is whether in that package you have solar, wind, geothermal, and then you have that biofuel. Now the question is, you know, should that biofuel, is that something that this group, you know, things should be in there or not? Is that something that should be, like you say, subsidizing? No, I think there are other things that can be done. I mean, there's a senator, at least Senator Lamar Alexander, who's 100%, and he's so against renewable fuels. He's against wind. He's the number one person against wind in the Senate. Well, you know, because he doesn't want to have windmills in the Smokies. He doesn't want to have windmills out in Nantucket Bay because he owns property up there. Maybe there's another reason. I'm sure he has his reasons, but and yet he votes for tremendous subsidies for oil and gas. Those are mind blowing. And so I mean there are things that Tennessee agriculture and can do and say, you know, we don't really think this is best for food security in Tennessee. So we think we should do something different, sir.
So we can change the vote.
We can change the vote. We can have a group where we can have a recommendation. We say we think we ought to have, you know, more solar for farms and less ethanol. We can actually have a co-op, say recommendation.
Well, and the assistant commissioner of revenue is moderating the panel, and so he can go up here and just find out what Tennessee state can. What we can do, and I think that the policy issue is a really important one, and that is where we as a state need to address what are our priorities, what can we do to support farmers, and at the same time make sure that you know, this is sustainability is not a bipartisan, you know, isn't a partisan issue, I guess, at all, based on all of our futures.
Well, first of all, one of the worst things in eating the meat and poultry is the, you think about the energy that goes into producing it. And so if we have animals grazing, you know, we're actually contributing to, you know, the good side of that, because you've got that root development constantly increasing organic matter and that sort of thing. And there's a lot more to it. But as far as the antibiotics in poultry, you know, we're really doing ourselves a disservice by buying any sort of meat that has had antibiotics used in its production. And you kind of got to be careful about that. Because I noticed Tyson was recently written up, or I forget what happened to him, but they were kind of, and I think they had their chicken pulled back that they were calling antibiotic free when the EPA had made some sort of mistake about a particular compound that they used in it, in its production, that actually had an antibiotic effect. And so they got slapped on the hand, and they got to change the label to say produced with without antibiotics that have an effect on, you know, human health or something.
And that's what their natural.
Yeah, that's their natural.
No USDA description for the world's natural.
There's not now. So, and if you buy something that's certified organic, it is not allowed to have any antibiotics used in its production. It's not allowed to have genetically modified organisms used in its production. It's not allowed to have like a whole list of restricted compounds like nitrates, you know, MSG, those sorts of things used in its production. And really, a lot of people are still learning about what organic is, because I have people asking all the time. I should just say, it's organic. And then they can ask whether it's grass-fed or not, because that's totally different. It doesn't have to be grass-fed to be organic. But then they say, does it have antibiotics used? Or, well, no, because it's organic. I don't know. But the antibiotic use, you know, the livestock grow faster.
And they only see that if they can pile as many in a combined stress with one, and it's really not helping you longer. The last comment from my
Shouldn't bump up what they're paying for. Interestingly enough, Hamilton County, Chattanooga makes more renewable energy components than any other county in the state, and the windmills that you see go out are made paid for. Second comment is, I'm also founder and chair of the Watershed Association. We're more impacted by soil erosion and development. But the comment about the rule of thumb on the leak, we're finding a direct connection between water and energy. We know that it takes 25 gallons of processed water to 1 kilowatt of energy. Save energy, save water, vice versa, save water. So that's a good rule of thumb for farm and industry.
But you know, the comment about wind energy and renewable energy, if you can't get your legislators to do it, you can also do it just by market demand. You can request things with green tax. You have electrical producers out there, and then you have distributors. And TVA, I don't know, they're probably both. But in Illinois, where I was from, ComEd was a distributor, but Exelon was their producer. And as a consumer, you can request your utility company to buy green energy. Tennessee may not be the best state. Do we? Okay, my apologies. So Tennessee may not be the best state for wind because of the topography. Midwest is probably a lot better as far as wind capacity, the stuff in the Dakotas, Illinois, Nebraska. And you can have, you know, fill that area with turbines, and actually those wind turbines actually help small farmers stay in business by their supplemental income. They're averaging about $4,000 a year per turbine in the Midwest. Yeah, and so it goes onto the grid and then eventually makes it, you know, down here to Tennessee. So if you can't get your legislator in Tennessee to support it, you can just do it through market demand and the consumer request from you.
Like supporting local farmers. Yeah.